Okay. In the section that we left off with, this is great men are not always wise. We talked about several people. David certainly made some bad choices. Solomon made some bad choices. Some of the better known characters in the Old Testament, we have several of their faults listed at various places. And then at the bottom of page 21, we have some information about Samuel. He was a great man, did many good things, very helpful to the nation of Israel, but he also was not completely without fault. 1 Samuel 8, verse 1, and I think you probably had this ready from last week or last time, but we'll look at it tonight quickly. And it came to pass when Samuel was old. It's interesting that this detail is inserted. That could be for a couple of reasons. It might be just to give us the time period, or maybe there's some additional information there to tie in with what we're talking about tonight. When he was at that time in life, he made who? His sons. What? Judges over Israel. And that might have been all right if his sons had been godly men, but the Bible tells us that that was not the case. 1 Samuel 8, verse 3 says, his sons walked or didn't walk in his ways. All right, didn't walk. And sometimes that happens to parents. They might be really good parents, sometimes not so good, but parents sometimes find themselves in this position where kids turn out in a way that they would not prefer. And they turned after filthy lucre, evil money, and they took bribes. Well, that's obviously bad in any realm. We find it sometimes in politics and shouldn't find it in religion, but sometimes that also happens. And they perverted, they turned away from justice or proper judgment. And then as you look at verse 5, what did Samuel's indiscretion lead to according to verse 5? All right, you know, we want a king. You know, we've seen how this has gone with your sons, with your kids, and it's just not going so swell. And, you know, that becomes a little difficult to defend when they're pointing to your family, what you've done, and it doesn't work out real well. Now, if you remember in the last class, I gave you the illustration. I wasn't quite sure where it was coming from. I knew it was part of the class. But if you go through a small town and you get caught speeding, just pay the fine, likely, because the system is probably corrupt. Well, that's what I was thinking of when we just didn't quite get to the end. So if you ever are in that situation, you try to fight the court ticket, you might find that it is a community where things are not just. Justice is being perverted, it's being twisted, and they're going to likely stick you with $750 to $1,000 extra in court costs, whereas you could have just paid the ticket, even though it might have been unjust, and that would have ended it. So it's up for you, but that's just kind of food for thought. Then this, the two examples that we've just looked at show us that older people can make mistakes too, sometimes big, sometimes devastating mistakes. I think that's important for us because sometimes as we try to communicate with people, they will say to us, well, thinking about the younger folks, you don't know it all. Well, that's true. And we're certainly fallible. We're subject to mistakes. But we have been around the block maybe a couple more times than you have at the age of 12 or 15. So at least some consideration should be given to our assessment of the situation. And we'll continue to look at that and make sure that that's right. That should be our attitude. But still, looking at the experience that you've had, the things that you've had a chance to study, compared to what we've had a chance to look at, our perspective should certainly get some weight, but we don't want to discount some of the ideas that young people may have as well. In this case, there was a whole kingdom that suffered, and it was just a bad deal. Then, that next to the last paragraph, the fact that one grows old and in his later years does some foolish things does not mean that God will mark him off the list. This, too, is one of the great points from this lesson. Do people sometimes go off the rocker in the older years? Ray says he hasn't got there yet. So, well, that's good news. But they do sometimes. You find that in religion. There are some guys that have put in a lifetime of service, and then they go on some tangent. Now, exactly how God deals with that, I don't know. I would be hopeful that maybe something has just kind of gone awry in the mind, and that's led them off in that direction. But you find some other people, in some cases, it's definitely medical related. There have been some examples of Christians who have gone into a nursing home. Maybe they pick up dementia, and it turns out they become very mean. I mean, they're snappy and they're snitty each time you see them. And I mean, they are just, you almost dread going to see them because you're thinking, wow, this is just not the person that I remember from way back when. Well, again, things can change. Sometimes it's health-related, some other things. So try to be sensitive to that and also try to be cautious about thinking, well, you know, I wish they would have died 5 or 10 years earlier when they were a solid Christian. Well, you know, God understands that things change, so it's good that we're in his hands, and just don't immediately write somebody off because they've gone through a process which we may not fully understand that's put them in a position which is a lot different than what they were typically throughout life.
We had an elder out there that, as he's gotten older, had more sickness and things, and he's become more bitter in life. He's no longer an elder. He stepped down about 6 or 7 years ago. But, with his older age and his health issues and things, it was harder to get along with.
Yeah, it is that. I'm thinking about a situation in Tennessee. There was a fellow, he was around 90, lost his wife, and he got grabby with the women. Now, he should have known better. But again, I'm not sure that something was completely right in the mind. So, you had there, in that situation, the ladies doing something that I thought was really good. You know, he would go up there, and let's just say for the sake of a good round age, you know, he's trying to kiss a 30-year-old lady on the lips. Well, that wouldn't be something that she was probably looking forward to for a variety of reasons. But rather than, you know, smack him or swat him, you know, they kind of knew, you know, after they got socked the first time right there on the lips, that, you know, incoming. You know, here this guy is headed towards me. So they're able to come up with strategies to deflect, to still kind of preserve some of his dignity and to make sure that things were done decently and in order. And that's a good way to go. Again, God's going to handle that situation ultimately, but if there's some things that we can do there, and with that elder, again, maybe, you know, I have no idea what it was like to communicate with him, but maybe start a conversation when it looks like he's headed off into bitterness where you can kind of distract him and do those kinds of things, because that's the golden rule, isn't it? I mean, if we were in that boat, we would want somebody to deal with us as kindly and as gently as they could. So it's really, really important. And then the reference in Nehemiah 9:17, this fact should help the very oldest among us to be thankful for God, who is ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness. And we should show those kinds of things to our brethren as well. Finally, perhaps it would be beneficial to each person who studies this lesson to list some blessing of growing older. Share your list with others in your class. All right, some of the good things about growing older. Oh, all right, retirement. What else?
More time to work for God.
All right. People, you know, if they're working, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week, they get home, they're tired, and I mean, it's just like, wow, my energy is just gone. So you find sometimes that people have more time to devote to spiritual things, or the schedule is a little more workable. What else?
You learn to let things.
All right, I think that's another thing. As people get older, maybe mellow out a little bit, some things are easier to deal with, let things go. Some things may not bother them as much. And if you, and I think this is one of the things that you might find, and it still might irritate them a little bit, but a lot of ladies like a clean house. If you talk to, and this is a general statement, so if you fall into the exception category, don't say, well, you're just dead wrong. We're just going to put you into a different group. But, you know, if you look at a 19, 20, 25-year-old lady who likes a clean house, that's probably going to be something that is not only important to her, but it's probably something that she really tries to keep up with. She hits 60, maybe even the 50s or in the 40s, 60s, 70s, 80s. She still might have that desire, but do you think she can live with a little more dirt? I would say a lot of ladies can probably say, okay, it's not as clean as it used to be 50 years ago, but it's not as big of a deal if I've got some dirty dishes in the sink, those kinds of things. So views change in some ways, and I would put that in the maturing category rather than, you know, I'm just forgetful or too old to do it category. What else?
Along those same lines, I guess you would say, it appears to me like as people get older, they gradually shift from looking at the outside, looking at appearances, judging the book by its cover, to switching over to every individual as a person, and they treat them as if they should be considered a person. Looks no longer mean anything. Handicaps no longer mean anything. Those sorts of things just sort of disappear.
Thought becomes more deliberate in a lot of ways. Whereas before you would have made a snap judgment about a person, now it's, okay, take in some other factors here. And it could be that judgment I would have made 30 or 40 years ago was wrong. So you begin to see people, hopefully, starting to take some of those Christian qualities, apply them in new, better, deeper ways, and they really become finer people. You know, they say some things age better with time, and I think in many ways that's true for the Christian. As you're trying to live a Christian life, you get better and better as the years go by.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I had somebody ask me questions. At your age, does sin still tempt you as much as it used to? I said, sin will always tempt you, but it's different. As you get older, things that used to tempt you when you was younger no longer tempt you, but there's other things that come your way. But the longer you're a Christian, the more you can push that off.
Right. Doug and I had a conversation a while back, and he made the point, which I think is true, and it's, again, not universally the case, but a lot of people with money, their view changes. You know, in the early years, somebody's getting out of college, they're looking at college debt, and the thinking is, we need money. You know, we've got debt, and we've got a new family, and we've got a car payment, and we've got a house payment. Money, money, money. But you know, as the years go by, and things become, and for most of us, I think, we're old enough to have gotten into that boat. You know, if we go down, anybody remember the early years of marriage? You were taking the calculator down the aisle and the shopping cart to make sure that you had enough money? All right, some of us have gone down that road. But now, how many are still taking the shopping cart down the aisle with the calculator?
Smart calculator.
Okay. All right. Well, the number. Okay. The number is less. But for the most part, I would say the resources that we have when it comes to the grocery store, we've come to a better position. So, you know, because of that change in circumstances, some things when it comes to money, just not as pressing on the mind. But there are going to be some of the things, for example, envy. You've got someone who has lost a lot of health and now looking at all those young, spry people out there able to do whatever they want. Or jealousy, those kinds of things. Boy, I sure wish I was 25 again. Or I sure wish I could run like he or she does, those kinds of things. So it does shift. But it's still always going to be there. The devil is always going to be able to throw something out. And in terms of that, think about that before the flood, as people were living 500, 600, 700 years. You think temptation changed a little bit when somebody was 500 compared to 20? I think it's probably going to alter a little bit with time. All right, anybody else before we move on to the next lesson? Dolores?
Hopefully as you're older, you have, it's easier to find time to study. When I had four little kids sitting in the pew, yeah. There were many Sundays when I'm not sure if I even heard what went on. And another older mother said, don't worry, because that will go, you know, that goes away, and you do get to study again after.
Yeah, you might not be able to hear, you might not be able to see well, but at least you've got the time to study. So,
about 20 years.
Yeah, but that is true. That shifts as well. And two, study might actually be more productive. Hopefully it would be in those years because you've been in Bible classes, you've had a chance to hear people and had a chance to read articles, those kinds of things. And now, you know, you're going to forget some of that stuff.
You're mixing those.
Yeah, and even I, preachers, you know, I'll be the first to attest that preachers forget stuff over the years. Something comes up and you think, wow, you know, I taught that, I preached that. Or when we were in Tennessee, this son-in-law, you know, he and Beth had been married for about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And it had to be while they were still dating. He said, you gave a sermon illustration one time. It must have been his first time here. Where you said, when you were at the Hummer plant, somebody came up to you and said, justify your job. Justify why you should be employed here. Well, I gave him an answer which satisfied him. But you know, when the son-in-law threw that out, immediately it didn't stick there in my recollection. And then I thought about it a little more and I thought, okay, I can't place what sermon that was in, but I do finally remember that statement. But I mean, that was, you know, that goes back about 10 years or so, and it was just kind of a really distant memory. But you do find those kinds of things, and as age comes and passes, it's helpful a lot of times. Okay, let's turn the page and think about something that is a good bit different. When I face the enemies of truth and conflict. So that's a long title. But we are going to face, we're going to experience sometimes some enemies. And the reason for that will be the truth conflicts with what some people believe. He begins by talking about the Lord's commission to the apostles. They were told, Matthew 28, 18 through 20. First account of that is to go into all the world, preach the gospel. And Jesus knew that that was not going to be a piece of cake. For that reason, he told the apostles that they were going to have those signs. Remember, in Mark 16, verses 17 through 20, you're going to be able to lay hands on people. You're going to be able to cast out demons. If you drink any deadly thing, it's not going to hurt you. Several, you're going to speak with new tongues, the ability to communicate in languages that you have never learned, those kinds of things. So he was helping his people be prepared for what they were going to face. We have a couple references here that we want to get lined up. Somebody for Matthew 10, we'll start with verses 16 through 18, and then ask you to read a few more verses after that, and then also we'll head somebody over to the book of 1 Kings chapter 22 and verse 8. Will somebody pull about three times? Okay, Steve, from Matthew 10. Let's start with Matthew 10, reading verses 16 through 18.
Behold, I sent you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them, to the Gentiles.
Okay, let's fill in the blanks and then think about some of what he said. The Lord said, first of all, behold, I, that's the Lord, am going to send you forth as what? As sheep. You're going to be like sheep. Well, if that had been where the Lord ended his analogy, what would that have suggested to them and to us? I'm going to send you forth and you're going to be like sheep. All right. It doesn't sound like they're going to be out there and be a bunch of lions and tigers and bears, does it? It sounds like you're going to be out there and without some help, you're going to be defenseless. You need to realize that you're not going to be, in many respects, the aggressor. You're going to be subject to some very serious things. But he went on to say something else. I'm going to send you forth as sheep. And then he says, in the midst. What's the word midst mean? All right, in the middle of, in the presence of, surrounded by, if you will. The Lord said, you're going to be like sheep and you're going to be surrounded by, you're going to be in the presence of wolves, plural. Now, only one wolf may not have been too bad if you're a flock of sheep. But you bring in wolves and you've got the wolves surrounding the sheep. That doesn't sound like a very enticing place to be. So the Lord uses very, very powerful imagery here to warn his people this is going to be difficult for you. Now, again, this is a limited commission, Matthew chapter 10. But still, even in the Great Commission, it was going to be very similar, hence the signs in Mark chapter 16. Then he gives an illustration. He says, I want you to, or it's a conclusion rather, therefore I want you to be wise as serpents or snakes, and they are pretty wise. And I want you to be harmless as doves. He went on to say, you need to beware of men. And here's the promise. They will, a time is coming when you will be delivered up to the councils and they will scourge you in the synagogues. The wolves are around you and they're not going to just stand idly by. They will attack you. And the Lord said you're going to be brought before governors and kings for what reason? He said for my sake, the gospel's sake, as you're trying to communicate this message. And he said that's also going to serve as a testimony against them and the Gentiles. Are we seeing some of that kind of stuff today? Not nearly to the degree that Jesus described, but at least kind of on the fringe, maybe. We're seeing some of that in our time? Yeah. And where do we see it?
We're seeing some here in our own country, but very predominant.
Yeah. With ISIS, ISIL, whichever brand of extremism that you want to point to, I mean, there's that. You're professing to be a Christian? Okay, come on down. Because we're going to lob off your head.
We even see our government turning against Christianity. I'm not talking about any particular Democrats or Republicans or whatever. The government in general is doesn't want Christianity in school, doesn't want Christianity in courthouses and things of that nature.
And in the workplace. There was one, there was a lady, she's, I'm thinking, 60s, 70s, a person who professes to believe in Christ, and I don't remember the state. I'm not sure what her business was, but the attorney general of her state, because it was one of the same-sex deals, I don't want to make the wedding cake, I don't want to be the wedding photographer for a same-sex marriage, those kinds of things. Somebody came by that wanted that kind of service. She said no, got brought to the attention of the government, and the state attorney general said, well, I'll tell you what. And I'm thinking because, she was part of the gray-headed group, the seniors, the attorney general said, well, just pay $2,000 and, a little bit more, and then we'll get off your back. And the lady said no. So I really appreciated her stance. People like that we should pray for, but it's starting here. As Ray mentioned, you've seen some of that with the school system, and now when they can come in and say to a government, or, say to a business, which I understand, you don't want to discriminate, but it's also the case if you are this loving, what word would I want to use there? From this a group of people, that is, people involved with same-sex relationships, and you're so loving, kind, and compassionate, when the guy says, I don't do those kinds of weddings, what should your love and compassion and kindness cause you to do? Well, find somebody else, right? Yeah, well, and that would be the logical, the sensible, the reasonable thing to do. But when somebody says, I'm going to sue you, well, that surely doesn't sound very kind, loving, and compassionate. So, again, you're getting a message there which conflicts because it's... I figured this out about 3 years ago. I think I taught it once and maybe mentioned it a couple times beyond that. But when you think about liberalism in the religious realm, and this also takes place in the spiritual realm, it's exactly parallel. You have people at level one, they say, you don't agree with this, but we just want you to tolerate us. That's where it starts. Once a group achieves, and this would also apply to false teachers, once they achieve toleration, what's level two? Well, we've got to be on the same level, because that's not fair. You're just tolerating me, and that's discriminatory. So you've tolerated me, now bring me up to the level of equality, and it doesn't stop there. It always rises to the third level. And what's level three?
I'm right, you're wrong.
Yes, superiority. And it's got to be my way, or you need to be hauled off to jail, or you need to be shut down as far as your free speech. So do not remember that. Or do not forget that. I didn't remember it. But you need to see that same pattern, because it just follows history through and through and through, whether you're dealing with the things in the secular world or whether you're dealing with things in the religious world. And it's a very common pattern. Okay.
That became the social issue. Because how many places do you still go to that says no shoes, no shirts, no service?
Yeah, no.
Discriminating me because I want to be half naked when I come to your place.
Sure. Now, they would argue that that's a hygienic issue, I think. Right. That, you know, we just can't have people.
But it wasn't before, though. And
no.
That was for a purpose.
Yeah. And if you think about that logically, there are a lot of things. For example, if you're a senior citizen and you go down to Wendy's, they give you a discount. Or McDonald's. You can just kind of take your pick of the restaurant. Well, how is that not discriminatory? Well, and that was going to be where I went next. If you've got an organization that says to military vets, we're going to give you a discount, you know, for example, if you're vet 10% off of what Lowe's offers to you. How is that not fair? Or how? Why is that not unfair to the non-vets in society? And yet people have been able to get away with, if a business, for example, says we'll knock 10% off if you bring in a church bulletin, they're not saying you've got to go to services. They're not even saying you've got to go to the religious group and get the bulletin from there. But if you bring in a bulletin, we're going to knock 10% off. And then they go out and holler, well, that's, you know, favoring this group or that group, or you're discriminating against atheists and so forth. But in those other places, they don't raise any kind of objection. So again, it goes back to sensibility and reasonableness and fairness. And it's going back to that third tier, which is we want to be superior to you and just shut you down. But it's you know, the world just doesn't think reasonably and correctly when we're trying to deal with spiritual things. Anybody else? Okay. Steve, if you're still in Matthew 10, let's now look at verses 21 and 22.
Now, brother will deliver a brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to
thank you. Once again, let's fill in the blanks and kind of think about what we're looking at. Jesus said brother would deliver a brother to death. The father, the child, the children shall rise up against their parents, cause them to be put to death, and you should be hated of all men. Or you might think of that as nations. Even various nations will hate you for my name's sake. But he that endures to the end will be saved. Now, why would people be delivering up family members to death? A couple reasons for that. Brother delivers up brother. Sister delivers up sister. Mom and dad turn over their kids to the authorities or vice versa. Why would they do that?
So they don't get punished.
Well, okay, sometimes it's kind of like the drug war. If the cops arrest you and they find that you've got a reasonable amount of some illegal narcotic on you, they might say, well, okay, we can work out a deal with you if what?
You deliver these.
All right. Let's go up the chain a little bit. Who's your preacher? Who are your leaders in the local congregation? Where are you guys meeting? And if you give us this information, we'll cut you loose or we'll offer you some kind of deal. Do you think they knew that strategy back in the first century?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, rolling over on the guy that is a little higher up in the food chain, it's been a very common practice for a long time. So that was one thing. Avoid personal persecution. Why else? Well, you've seen enough TV to know about informants. What's an informant do, and why does he do it? All right. Now, in this particular case, he's not been convicted of anything, has he? For all practical purposes, his hands are clean. He's not, you know, killed anybody. He's not beaten anybody up in this particular case. He might not even be a Christian. But, you know, he's not a Christian, but his brother is. Looking for some quick cash? Let's go over there to the Romans, and let's go ahead and deliver him up, because it's worth a quick 50 bucks or whatever. It's been done. Anything else? Okay. We've seen that today, haven't we? Kids will sue their parents in court. They don't like this, that, or the other thing, so we're going to report mom and dad to the authorities, and we'll let the government handle them. Well, again, that same kind of thing could happen, even maybe in the younger years. You know, call up the military forces or the police forces, whatever they had in that day and time, and say, we're turning in our family members. It's interesting, as you go back and you look at history, throughout history, there were, and I'm using the word Christian here in a very general sense, there were people that had special designations. There were some people that were known as confessors. And that is, if a person, if a Christian was brought to the authorities and charged with being a Christian, they would confess, yes, I believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, I'm one of his followers, those kinds of things. And if you made that confession in a time of hostility and persecution, well, you could be punished, you might be stretched in the rack, or it might be that, you know, your life was taken or something in between. You know, maybe starved to death or maybe just punished for a certain period of time. And then there were some people that were known as runners. What do you think a runner was? Persecution? And the brethren stand up and say, well, we had a runner this last week. Joe's a runner. All right. He's the fellow who escapes. He doesn't want to deny Christ, but he also doesn't want to stand for it. So he's trying to kind of bridge the difference there. So Joe packs up his bags and flees town, hoping that he can find a better place. There are also liars. In this day and time, it was possible to secure a government document, and that document would have said, it would be like today, you would sign an affidavit. No, I was not at the convenience store when it was robbed. Well, you were. But because you know that some bad consequences will follow from that, you just lie and say, you know, that wasn't me. So in this particular case, there would be some people who would actually lie. And then you have the other group, which we talked about earlier, and they would be the traitors. They're the people that Jesus specifically talks about here. They deliver up mom, dad, brother, sister for money, or maybe they were angry, or maybe they were trying to go ahead and cut a deal for themselves, those kinds of things. So when truth conflicted in the first century and in several centuries that followed, people did a lot of things, and not all of them were noble or right. Thoughts before we pick up verses 34 to 36. Loris?
If you take it in a different, to a different place, in the Middle East, the Muslims will give up their sisters if a Christian has converted them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, family or no family, you are now going to be stoned to death.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's true too. I mean, when you look at truth and the Bible, it has some powerful, powerful consequences. And it literally just, like I say, sometimes cuts two people or organizations or relationships right in half. Anybody else? Okay, one more time, Steve, if you would. Matthew 10, 34 to 36.
Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household.
Okay, fill in the blanks. Jesus said, I didn't come to send
peace.
Well, that's not literally true. He does want peace on earth. But again, that's got to be peace through the terms God has given. And because most are not willing to obey the word that he's given, he mentioned that in Matthew 7, the Sermon on the Mount, he says, ultimately, the message he came, the system he offers us through Christianity is a sword. And it's going to cause what? Man is going to be at variance. There's going to be a lack of harmony there, maybe even hatred against his father, the daughter against her mom, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. Well, we've heard the old statement, blood is thicker than water. What would Jesus have said about that?
Jesus
Not always. So the people who are truly committed to him, they want the best for their family. They want everybody in their blood line, if you will, to be in a right relationship with God. But he knew that that's not always going to be the case. And if you've talked to some family members who have some different ideas about religion, those can be some pretty testy conversations sometimes. Not necessarily because you're creating tension, but trying to tell people this is right, this is what we find in the scriptures, and it doesn't go well. So if you've ever had to go down that road, welcome to the club. It's not a fun club to be in, but it is not, it's a fairly popular club. All right, anybody else before we look at our 1 Kings 22 reference? Okay, let's read that now. 1 Kings 22, verse 8. Who had that? Didn't we get somebody lined up for that? Okay, all right. 1 Kings 22, 8. Is anybody there who want to read it? All right, Lois has got it. Okay, here is a prophet of God. He's known to the highest ranks of the government. And the king says, I love the guy to death. No, I hate him. I despise him. Why? Because he never had anything good to say relative to the king and his work. Let's also head somebody over. I'm going to say a little bit more about this paragraph, but let's move somebody over to the book of Revelation, chapter 16, verses 8 and 9. We spent a good bit of time on these verses way back when, but I want to cover them again. Revelation 16, 8 and 9, you've got a couple minutes to get there. Who wants to head over there and get it? All right, Betty. Okay, the first part of the paragraph, he says, preaching the truth, teaching the truth involves telling people what they should and should not do. Well, sometimes it's a little more forceful than should. I mean, it's either repent or perish because of what we're dealing with. And if you have situations that you can look back on and say, well, I tried to teach this person. You may have dealt with some difficult topics. If you're dealing with adultery, if a guy's living with a girl or a girl's living with a guy, shacked up, or maybe you've got, that would be fornication, but if you've got a married guy that's involved with somebody, you've got a married woman that's involved with somebody, you've tried to talk to them about the relationship that they're in, to use the world's definition for that, what kind of reaction do you usually get? Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm penitent, I'm going to call it off and become a faithful Christian again. What do you hear?
Get out of my business.
All right. Get out of my business. It's none of your business. What else do we hear? I'm happy. It's my life. This is my right. Who are you to judge me? You can just go down the list. And those are at least some of the things that I've heard. Gambling, again, it's the same kind of thing. You have people involved with that, and they will justify it. Not in a good way. But it's my money, I've earned it, I can spend it however I want, this is my right, and it just goes on and on. Greed, pride, homosexuality, religious error. Rob, the preacher from Willowdale, wanted to go up and check out some books. So yesterday he and I went up to Grand Rapids to do some looking that was designed to benefit both of us. And in one of the bookstores, there was a book, I didn't buy it, I just kind of skimmed the contents and tried to commit the title to memory. But I like the title, and maybe one of these days I'll take that theme and preach it. But the title of the book was Respectable Sins. I thought that was a pretty wise title. I think it was a good idea for the book. What would you put in there if you were going to write a book and the title was Respectable Sins? Oh, come on, it shouldn't be that hard. Respectable sins, acceptable sins.
White lies.
All right, lying.
Still lies.
Yeah, there you go, lying. You can put in, you can develop that from, you can take a whole chapter on that and develop that in different ways.
I would think of something that I have done privately, and I don't share with anybody else. I'm not encouraging anybody else. I still am standing before God.
Okay.
But you're not going to know about it until my...
Right. So as long as we keep it private, you know, private sins are respectable sins because they're not going to shame my family or they're not going to affect my work. So that would be a different way to go at it, but that would be very good.
Respectful might be you doing something to help somebody else that good might come to them. So that would, they said, well, he did wrong, but it ended up turning out good for this individual. So
okay.
That was a respectable sin.
The end justifies the means,
right,
kind of thing. So,
means.
Yeah. So again, kind of along with Ray's thought there. That would not be a specific sin in the sense of lying, but it's kind of a category, if you will, where you could tie different things in there. So yes, that would also be good. I don't think he dealt with that in the book, but those are great ideas. What else?
Does it cause harm to anybody?
Okay, there again, that would, I'm going to put that in the same kind of thing, which you could almost probably have a companion volume for that, where you take those general ideas of the world and say, well, this is justified, whatever that might be, because of this reason. What else? What about greed?
Social drinking.
All right. You have some people that with some social issues, they would go ahead and say if it's to a certain degree, it's going to be acceptable. What else?
Jealousy, which is...
All right. You know, jealousy and anger and envy. And there again, you could kind of tie into the categories, you know, that the three here we're talking about. Because again, everybody does it. Everybody gets angry. Everybody gets jealous. Everybody's envious, those kinds of things. So very, very interesting concept to explore. But if you try to deal with those kinds of things, as he says, you start dealing with those kinds of issues and people are not going to be happy. In bold, he says, the wicked do not like to be disturbed. Well, that is the understatement of the day. Look at Revelation chapter 16, verses 8 and 9. Lois? 16, 8 and 9, uh-huh. Oh, I'm sorry. Boy, I'm just really off today. It's all right. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. So it's okay.
16:8-9.
Yeah.
And the fourth poured out his bowl upon the sun, and it was given unto it to scorch men with fire, and men were scorched.
Mm-hmm.
And men were scorched with great heat and blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues. They repented not to give him glory.
Okay, now we're not going to go through all of Revelation 16, but the upshot of the thought there is that people are exposing folks, the unsaved, to God's Word. And as God's Word is put forth there to them, they feel like they're being scorched with fire. And if you talk to people about the Bible, for example, you go to the adulterer, you go to the guy, you know, that is involved with fornication, and you start saying, hey, look, here's what the Bible speaks about that. I mean, it's just like pouring, you know, gas on somebody and lighting a match. I mean, they do not want to hear it. I mean, this is in their mind, their life, and it's their choice and their decision, and this is what they feel is good, and maybe even that's what they feel God has led them to because they had a bad relationship in the past, all those kinds of things. And if you start any conversation which says this is contrary to the Scriptures, they just feel like, you know, you just turn the blowtorch on them. So John recognizes that principle as well. In Revelation chapter 16, verses 8 and 9. And some of us have been kind of scorched after we tried to share some information and the people felt like they got burned.
Really like John the Baptist.
Yeah. When he actually mentions him, I don't know that we'll get that far tonight, but we'll see. But again, when you look at Herod and what happened with John the Baptist, I mean, John comes along and says, it's not lawful to have her. You've got this guy standing up against you, the one who has great authority and power. You've got the right legally to take his head, and yeah, even though he's being held for a while, he wasn't immediately executed. Herod had to feel like, yeah, I got singed again. So, well, and think about Felix, isn't it Acts 24, maybe 24, 25, and as Paul reasoned of righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, feeling he was terrified and said, you know, go away when I have a more convenient season. He wasn't thinking, hey, this was a real great sermon. I would just love the Bible study. Now, he does communicate with him, but again, you get that sense that I can only take so much right now. Anybody else? Okay, let's see what we've got here just at the bottom of 23. We shall see the truth in conflict and the examples that follow. The proclaimers of truth were disdained because they delivered it faithfully to the hearers. He mentions Elijah and the false prophets. Going back to 1 Kings chapter 18, you've got the prophet here in contest with Baal and his prophets. Ahab, looking at verse 18 there, accused Elijah of troubling Israel. And the question is, what was the reply? God's prophet said, it's not me, the problem is with you. It's with your father's household. You're not following God, you've forsaken God, and you're having fellowship with the Balaam. So you've made the wrong choices, and it's because of your sin that we're dealing with the issues at hand. And then you have in verses 23 and 24 of this chapter, what was the test to determine which God could prove his real deity according to the prophet's suggestion. We're going to get two what? Two animals that were... Oh, okay. I was looking for the specific animal, but that's right. They were sacrificed. All right, two bulls, or some translations we use the word bullock, and we're going to dress them out, and where are we going to put them? On the altar. And are we going to light them up? No. We're going to see which God is able to do that. So Baal failed. The people, you know, cut themselves. They called out until the time of the evening sacrifice, and it just didn't work. And then finally, you've got God's prophet, water is brought in, and everything is basically demolished. And then as you look at verse 39, tell what all the people said when Elijah had completed his offering. What did they say? The Lord is God. How many times did they say it? Two. So you see there, I think, some emphasis. The Lord is God. The Lord is God. 1 John 4, verse 1, let's also get to that, and this may be a good stopping point for us. John said, beloved, believe not every spirit, but do what? Try, test, prove, check out the spirits to see whether they are of God. Because many false prophets are gone in the world. If you look through the most recent edition of The Advocate, there was an article in there by Everett Ferguson. He's a fellow who has written a lot. His name is recognized to a great degree among those who are classified as scholars. And he made a point which I had never thought of. If you take a look and see what he wrote in the last edition of The Advocate, he said, try the spirits, but he said, try the scholars. Now that was kind of inserted from his standpoint because of who he is and what his work involves. But you know, I thought that's a good point. Today, a lot of people, I believe, are intimidated by the so-called scholars. Here's a person who comes up and says, this is where I was educated. This is the degree that I have, and it's a terminal degree. You can't go any further than this, those kinds of things. And because of what I am and what I've done and where I've studied and what I know and you need to believe me. Well, no. We're going to go back and compare what you've said to the scriptures. Maybe it lines up. Maybe it lines up partially. Maybe it doesn't line up at all. But we have that obligation. We have that duty to test the scriptures, and that's what we need to do. He goes on to finish that out. He says, Elijah knew that God had the power and that the truths he preached were divine. They were right. Kind of the truth to power thing, so he had no fear of the Baal worshippers. And today, that should be our mentality as well. If we've got the truth, if we're looking at it in black and white, even if everybody in the world says, no, that's not right, we don't believe it, you're wrong, what should we do? Still teach it, still stick with it, because we can't be wrong if it's in God's Word. But a lot of people, they want to be the runner that we talked about earlier, they want to be the traitor, they don't want to be the confessor, but we need to stick up for what's right.